Thank you for coming here tonight. You know, tonight is pretty much your night, and I think I need to explain what I mean by that. So much has happened since I began to lecture here in Dallas. Very, very exciting. Many Jewish people have come back to the Jewish faith. But the work of the evangelical community continues. As you know, there are today more missions to the Jews in the United States than when I began this lecture back in January of this year. And they have the same message. I could prove to you from the Jewish scriptures that Jesus is the promised Messiah. And that's a very important statement. And today we're dealing with more than 470 missions to the Jewish people just in this country. By the way, there are other kinds of Christians that would not say that. I mentioned in some of my lectures that Catholics today are not at all interested in Jewish evangelism. By and large, if you meet a Catholic, they will probably not try to convert you. They'll be most respectful of what you believe. I mean, I know if I have to go, if I'm visiting a patient of mine in a hospital, I don't have to worry that the priest is going to try to convert that person. On the contrary, I usually can find out from the priest where I can get a good kosher meal and so on, where I can daven mincha. I mean, why is that? Why is the Catholic Church today really not involved in Jewish evangelism? The reason is because the Catholics today are not fundamentalist Christians. When more than 80% of Catholics today disagree with the Catholic Church on fundamental issues such as abortion and contraception, we're not dealing with, how do I say it, a firm community of Catholics. It, of course, speaks a lot of Pope John Paul II in terms of his own charisma and personality that keep so many Catholics who aren't what we would call very committed Catholics in terms of catechism, but keeps them in the church. And indeed, a year ago at this time, Life magazine did an extensive article on Christian leaders. And one of the Christians that they interviewed in Life magazine was the Archbishop of New York, Cardinal O'Connor. And in a four-line interview, Cardinal O'Connor says that you can't prove Christianity from the Bible. It's a matter of faith. It's a matter of faith. You either believe it or you don't believe it, but you cannot prove it from the Bible. But then we have like the kind of crossover. We have the Catholics that are saying these things, ideas that Catholicism holds, by the way, that Protestantism rejects. Mary, for instance, according to Catholicism, wasn't just a virgin when she conceived with Jesus in her womb. Matthew 1, 22 and 23, but on the contrary, she kept her virginity throughout her life, and perpetual virginity. And when we see brothers and sisters of Jesus in the New Testament, they're not really brothers and sisters, they are cousins. Naturally, a lot of Protestants wince when they hear that. They're very uncomfortable with it. By the way, I should tell you that Catholics do have their basis. You have to remember, and I know I've said this to you before, but you know, when a Protestant walks around and he feels very comfortable with his Christianity, and he says, "Ami, Protestant, sola scriptura. I only believe in what the Bible says, that's it." I mean, at least Catholics know what they believe is tradition, church tradition. But you have to remember, who even decided that the books of the New Testament were to be canon and which books were not to be canon? Who decided that the book of Hebrews, that the book of Matthew was to be part of the canon and the book of the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Thomas was to be outside of the canon? It was decided by Catholics at the Council of Nicaea. And who even decided that Matthew was written by Matthew? And I've said this to you before. It's not like the book of Matthew ends and the writer says, "Yours truly, Matthew." It's not like the book of Luke ends and says, "Your friend Luke." No, not at all. It's a church tradition that Matthew is the author of Matthew and Luke is the author of the third gospel. What we are more sure of is that the author of the third gospel is the same author as the book of Acts. And is almost certainly a Gentile, and is someone who certainly was very close to a man named Paul, because the book of Acts is a very important book in getting us from Peter. That's where Acts begins. Chapter 1 through 9 is basically about Peter, and after that it's all about Paul. It's getting us from a Peter who was this Orthodox type Jew who may have kept Shabbat, who may have kept kosher laws in all probability. Certainly the book of Acts would lead us to believe that he did. And suddenly Peter has the dream and he sees a sheep coming down, and on it are unclean animals, and he hears a voice saying, "Kill them and you may eat them." And then Cornelius comes into the picture, and so on and so forth. And then Paul becomes a minister to the Gentiles. And then, of course, the book of Galatians belongs right there. The Magna Carta of the Christian religion. So when Protestants, of course, with the back of their hand, cast away Catholics, cast away their doctrine, they should think a few times and remember so much of what they believe is based on the decisions that Catholics made for them. Even the very concept of the Trinity, the word Trinity, wasn't invented by a Protestant, it was invented by Tertullian, who didn't really believe in it. And I've mentioned this to you, he believed that Jesus was subordinate to the Father, and that's why he didn't have that word saint before his name. The Catholic Church fathers that have the word saint, they were the ones who believed in the Trinity, how it is believed today. Homoousia, one substance, but three persons. So it's important for you to understand that this lecture series that we've done here has nothing to do with the person who says, "Look, I can't prove to you that Jesus is the Messiah. I just believe it on faith," meaning without evidence. This lecture has nothing to do with you. Nothing at all. We are dealing with the statement that I can prove to you from the Old Testament that Jesus is the promised Jewish Messiah. Someone says to you, "I believe that Muhammad is the final and greatest prophet." Well, that's your business. Someone says, "I believe the tree in my backyard is God." Go ahead. But don't tell me that you can prove it from the Bible. That's important to understand. That's why some people call me up and they say to me, "Well, I believe it on faith." And you know what's interesting is sometimes evangelicals play both sides. When I say play, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but they find themselves vacillating from one extreme to the other. I was speaking at a Protestant university in the Northeast a few weeks ago. And one of the professors said to me after the lecture, he said to me, "Well, I know that Isaiah 7:14 is clearly referring to a contemporaneous situation where Ahaz, the king of Judah, was surrounded by two vast armies that wanted to destroy him. And it's very clear that it was the child that was then who was the sign. But we believe on faith that there is a dual prophecy." And I'm sure many of you have heard that term. It isn't in the Bible. "But we believe on faith that it's also pointing to Jesus in the future." So somehow when they are cornered, somehow when they're presented with a body of evidence that's so overwhelming, suddenly the evangelical will turn to faith that, "I believe this is also referring to Jesus." This has nothing to do with that. This lecture series, the work that we're doing here, has nothing to do with that statement. You want to believe that on faith? That's your business. But there is one other little problem here. And the little problem is, there's an empirical imperative. I need to explain what I mean by that. That is, every one of these Christians will admit, that one moment before Jesus was born, ask any Christian, one moment before Jesus was born, who had the truth? What would every honest Christian have to say? They'd have to say the Jews. Up until that moment, as a matter of fact, every Christian would have to say to you, "I as a Christian hereby say to you that my great-grandparents were pagans. They worshipped trees, they worshipped the stars and the moon. And your great-grandparents too? Your great-grandparents worshipped the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I say to you as a Christian that your great-grandparents were correct and mine were completely off base. They were wrong." But at the moment of Jesus, suddenly my faith now becomes true and yours is untrue. Suddenly the status has changed at that moment. Remember, that's the statement of every Christian. Every Christian would have to say to you that up until Jesus, you were right and I was wrong. Then the question is, who is the burden of evidence on? Is are we really two religions simply competing on equal toes here? Is that really the case? If one moment before Jesus the Jews had the truth, and if they will admit, and every Christian has to admit, that the Jewish people heard God's voice at Sinai, and they heard God say that I am the only God, you shall have no other God before me. Exodus 20, don't worship anything that flies in the heaven above or walks on the ground below. Don't do it. And yes, you heard at Sinai that Sabbath is holy. And there is no question about which day of the week. It's the seventh day of the week. It's Shabbat. Every Christian has to admit, oh yes, you heard God's voice at Sinai telling you to keep the Shabbat holy. And it's forever. Oh see, it's a sign for all generations, forever and ever. But that's okay, because you don't have to keep the Sabbath anymore. It's not necessary. Why? Because I have faith that you don't have to. Think about that just for a moment. You see what I'm saying? So first of all, when people come to me and when you're thinking, you say, well, I spoke to a Christian, he said dual prophecy. And what's really happening is, by the way, whatever someone believes in, they simply pour into it. You know, for instance, Deuteronomy 18, when it speaks about God raising unto you a prophet like Moses, so the Christians pour into who they want to pour into, the Muslims pour into, right? Christians say it's talking about Jesus, Muslims say Deuteronomy 18 is referring to Muhammad. Just pour into it whoever you want to pour into it. But are we really here on equal footing? Is there an imperative that Christians do more than just say, I believe on faith, without any body of evidence, when everybody will agree that yes, 1 hour before Jesus was born, the Jews had the truth? It is very exciting to be here in Dallas, you know. As I look around at the faces I see here, and so many of us had the opportunity to speak before this lecture and to speak on the phone, and of course I want to encourage every one of you, you know, our phone number is in the front of the study guide for a reason, and so many of you have called and spoken, and many of you, Jew and Gentile, have come to the Jewish faith. Many Jewish people, many of you sitting here, were Christians before they started to study. Hear both sides and make an informed decision. Some of you, as a result of coming back to your Judaism and leaving the church, you have been reviled by the church. You've lost many of your friends. For some of you, it was a very big surprise. You didn't expect that to happen. And I won't tell you that there isn't a sacrifice to embrace the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There is a great sacrifice. For some of you, it's greater than others. There are other people. We got a call one day on the phone. All kinds of odd things happen. We must have an overnight delivery of the tape series. Could you send it, you know, red label UPS overnight? I said, sure. And the address was the First Methodist Church in the South. Okay, so send the tape series. 1 week later, to the day, I get a phone call, and I ask them for permission to talk about this, and I get a phone call, and it's David. He is the pastor of, and he says, Rabbi, I've always had an interest in the Jewish people. I always understood my Christianity from where it emerged from the Jewish people. I always had a love for the Jewish people. And I studied, and my wife and I, we studied for this past week, the tapes, and we've gone over these lectures. It's all the Bible. And I want to convert to Judaism. Well, the story doesn't end there. He said, I have a problem. What's your problem? He says, I'm a minister of this church. So, there's always something new and juicy that comes up. So I said to him, look, you've got to square with them. I mean, it would be a good idea if you tell them what you believe now. And, you know, and I'll work with you, and we'll work together and make this work. She said, fine. And he went to his board, and the president and all the big machras were there. And he told them. And their answer is not exactly what he had expected. What do you think they told him? No, they didn't say get out. They said, I'm sorry, we have a contract with you till June of 1996. He said, I don't know if you heard me. But I don't believe in this anymore. I want to be a Jew. And they said, then teach us Judaism. He emailed me on my email address, tovia@j51.com, and told me that his next sermon was on why the Trinity was wrong and why one must believe in only one God, and his president told him it was the best sermon he had ever given. But we continued to talk. He wanted to know, a lot. He had a lot of questions. I told him it was permissible to do that as a Gentile. He's allowed to be in a church and teach Judaism. And I saw that this man had a special neshama, he had a special soul, there was something very unique about him, because Gentiles generally don't want to convert to Judaism. It's not natural. It's unnatural. It's coming, the Jewish people coming out is not a natural thing. That's why the Jewish people had to be born to people that were sterile, who couldn't even bear children. The world can't stand us, they have to spit us out, because we came into this world in an unnatural way. A woman like Sarah should have never been able to conceive. And I said to him, I believe that you are a Jew and you have a Jewish soul that's crying out. Do you have grandparents, great-grandparents from Spain or Portugal, perhaps, where so many Jewish people were forced to convert to Christianity? And he said, not exactly, but I have to tell you something, Rabbi. He said, my father passed away a number of years ago. He was no friend of the Jewish people. His feelings were nothing like mine. He had negative views about Jews, putting it mildly. But I always had a love for the Jewish people. And before my father was dying, before he was going to die, I actually made a trip to the land of Israel for the very first time in my life, and when I had come back from the land of Israel, I brought with me a talis in a beautiful velvet bag. My father was already on his deathbed, and I came into the room, my father was laying there on his bed, and very proudly I opened up this velvet pouch, and I took out a prayer shawl, and I put it on his stomach. His face, he said, turned white like a sheet, and he pushed it off his body and threw it on the floor. His father passed away a few days later. After his father died, he and his brother began to clean the attic. His father's taking all his father's things, and they found a shoebox with letters in it, bound. And they opened it and they began to look through the letters, and they found a very interesting letter from their father's father to their father. The father's father they had never met. And they opened up the letter and they began to read it. And it said this: how could you have done this to us? How could you have converted to Christianity and left your Jewish people? A lot of very interesting things happened, but there's a soul that's crying out for truth. And for we are now approaching the month of December, and well, we are going to all be bombarded with Christmas and so on. And so a lot of suicides this time of the year, you know. I'm not sure why. I think it's probably the music, you know. I mean, no, I'm not kidding. What happened? No, it's not. It's something that's okay, but it's like, you know, it's like, oh, I want a bell, you get a bell, you got to get a sugar there. So you have to sort of get ready for this time of the year. Yeah. Now, as you know, that evangelical Christians will tell you that every aspect of Jesus' life was foretold in the Old Testament. That's what Christians called the Old Testament. Not just the fact that he was born of a virgin. Oh no, that's not enough. But the very city that he was born in, Bethlehem, the Bible says that the Messiah had to be born in Bethlehem. It predicts it in the book of Micah. Now, it's important for you to know that there are 27 books in the New Testament, but only two of them mention that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. The book of Matthew and the book of Luke. No one else mentions it. They do it a little bit differently. Matthew has Jesus start out and the family start out in Bethlehem, and then they eventually wind up in Nazareth, and Luke has everyone start out in Nazareth and eventually wind up in Bethlehem. So they come from different directions, and it's a different type of story, of course, because Matthew is connecting the birth of Jesus to the death of Herod the Great, to his last days. So therefore, little Jesus had to get out of Israel and go to Egypt to get out of harm's way of Herod the Great. Now Herod the Great is dead in 4 BCE, we know that. And of course Luke is connecting Jesus' birth with the census of Quirinus. The government, the Roman Empire, was literally counting how many people were there for taxation purposes. And that's happening around the year 6 CE, and so there's a little bit of a difference, and that's often referred to as the gospel problem, the synoptic problem. But that's not really relevant. Now, the verse that Christians will tell you, that evangelical Christians will tell you, that I can prove to you from your Bible that Jesus, that the Messiah, had to be born in Bethlehem, comes from the Jewish scriptures, from the prophet Micah. And I'd like you, if you would, to open up your study guide. For someone who does not have access to this, please raise your hand. Now, this is the verse that Christians will tell you where you can prove that the Messiah had to be born in Bethlehem. Now, we're looking at it out of a New Jerusalem Bible, which is a Christian Bible, and you'll see it on the top, Micah 5. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, the least of the clans of Judah, from you will come for me a future ruler of Israel, whose origins go back to the distant past, to the days of old. Well, here very clearly, evangelicals will tell you, very clearly we have a prophecy that proves that the Messiah had to be born in Bethlehem. But that's where things get a little odd. Because this is a Christian Bible, and this Christian Bible, the translator, also has an annotation on the bottom explaining what you're reading. And you see the arrow there pointing? He says something very interesting, because not all Christians agree with this, and that's important for you to understand. You remember when we were looking at Isaiah 7:14, how the King James translates Alma as virgin, and I showed to you that the vast majority of modern Christian translators agree with the Jewish people, and we've seen that in Daniel 9. In general, most modern Christians translators and scholars agree with the Jewish people on translation, and even sometimes on understanding. Let's take a look exactly in that paragraph where that black arrow is pointing, but in the middle of that line. This Christian is saying to us, Micah is thinking of the ancient origin of the dynasty of David. And of course he brings out Ruth 11, and we'll find out the significance of that in a moment. And Samuel 17:12, the evangelist later interpreted this passage as a prophecy of Christ's birthplace. What does that mean? What he's saying here is that originally when this was written about King David and his birthplace, but later on the evangelists, the church fathers, the earliest church fathers, the writers of the New Testament, the very authors, reinterpreted this to now refer to Jesus. Now, what would make him say that? What would make this Christian say something that I'm sure he would rather not say, and that is, it's very clear from this verse that this is really referring to King David's birthplace rather than the birthplace of the Messiah. What would make him say that? Watch with me. Let's turn the page, please. Now, if we read the first half of the verse, you see part A, just broke the verse up into parts. Well, let's take a look at it. The first half of the verse reads, "And you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, you should have been the lowest of the clans of Judah. From you shall emerge for me to be a ruler over Israel." Ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you, does that sound like it might be saying that the Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem? Yes, it sure does. Isn't that fair? Right? "And you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, you should have been the lowest of the clans of Judah. From you shall emerge for me to be a ruler over Israel." That's absolutely fine. It's not saying explicitly, but it certainly seems to be implying very strongly, if all we have is the first half of that verse, it seems to be implying very strongly that the Messiah would certainly be someone from Bethlehem, and saying that the person would be born there is certainly not a very big stretch at all. We can feel very comfortable with it. So from the first part of Micah 5, it works out just fine. There's nothing wrong. Nothing in the first half would encourage any Christian or Jew to say that this is not saying that this is the Messiah's birth. That's where we have the problem. It's that second half of the verse, part B. That's the disaster. Now it's giving us the connection. "And his origin is from old, from ancient days." Micah is telling us something very special here. And that is, if you want to know what the connection between the Messiah and Bethlehem is, the origin, and by the way, the word in Hebrew is umaitzaisav. What does that word mean? We say it, that's our blessing that we make on bread, don't we? What blessing do we make when we eat bread? Hamotzi lechem in earth. Same root. What does the word hamotzi mean?
Brings forth.
The actual, the source. It comes forth from the ground. Hamotzi lechem in earth. Who brings forth bread from the land, from the ground. So what Micah is telling us here is, and remember, Micah lived a little bit after King David, a couple of centuries, and he is saying that you want to know where the Messiah who's going to be in the future, both according to Christianity and Judaism, from Micah, the Messiah still is going to be in the future. Micah, by the way, was a contemporary. For those of you who are not familiar with this man of God, Micah was a contemporary of a much more famous prophet, the prophet Isaiah, and the prophet Hosea, and Amos. He was a contemporary of Hezekiah. Now it gives you a sense. In secular chronology, he lived about the year 732 BCE, around that time. And he's saying to you, if you want to know what the origin of the Messiah, how does he connect to Bethlehem? It's from the past, from ancient days. By the way, King David, Bethlehem, you might have not been aware of it, but King David is called the Bethlehemite. Take a look, if you would. Move down just a little bit with me. You see it there in the gray box that doesn't have a frame? 1 Samuel 17:58. "And Saul said to him, 'Whose son are you, young man?' And David said, 'The son of your bondsman, Jesse the Bethlehemite.'" Well, now we know where that comes from. And I put together a timeline for you. You see on the bottom of the page, on the top names, you'll see those are the names we're directly interested in. And the names that are underneath the line, the episodes beneath the line, give you a sense of history and when they lived and when they preached. And of course, Micah's there, and he's looking to the future. And that's what the Bible has in view here. Looking to the future. Looking at the Messiah, and he's saying, you want to know where his origins are? From ancient days. But you know what's interesting is, it says in the beginning of that verse, it says that you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, although you are the least of, or the smallest of Judah. What does that mean, the smallest? Ask a question. Explain to me what that means, that Bethlehem is the smallest. Is Bethlehem the smallest city in Judah? No. But something about Bethlehem was tarnished. There was a problem with Bethlehem. But what does it mean that you are the smallest? And the word is Tsair. For me, ear means, it's almost a derogatory.